The Great Depression had already begun making its way through the United States. While the early 1920s might have been roaring and lively, the late 1920s and 30s were anything but bright. People still had to eat. They still had to have shelter. They still had to have their basic needs met for them and their families. Even though the world seemed to be slowing down, they couldn't slow down with it. So when word spread in 1930 that a company in West Virginia was looking for workers to help build a tunnel, men came from near and far to see if the news was true. And it was. It was an answered prayer. It was a job when jobs weren't easy to come by. But little did they know that the town that was open for hire would soon be called the Town of the Living Dead. This is Hannah Morgan with Into the Tunnel, a podcast that tells the story of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster. It was 1930 in Fayette County, West Virginia, and Union Carbide was finally ready to begin the project. But at this time, no one knew something deadly was around the corner. Actually, this project was something that some hoped would be good for the state. Little did they know, the tunnel project would soon go down in history as one of the biggest industrial disasters in the country. To learn more about the Hawk's Nest project, I spoke with Dr. Billy Joe Payton over Zoom. He explained that West Virginia had sort of entered the Depression before the Great Depression spread across the nation. By the mid-1920s, the coal industry in West Virginia had overextended itself during World War I. Since the coal industry seemed to be growing, they ended up producing more and more coal. But in the post-war years, it was more coal than was needed. This resulted in unemployment in the state reaching high levels by the 1930s that were much higher than the national average.
So the project itself was viewed as basically a, you know, kind of a bonus to create jobs. Thousands of workers eventually came to work on the tunnel project, including laborers from all over the South, mainly, in order to dig this tunnel.
Dr. Payton is a professor of history at West Virginia State University. However, this event isn't just another tragic event that's heard about in classrooms. For him, it's an event that holds family ties.
My father is from Glen Ferris, grew up in Glen Ferris, and his older brother, Arthur Payton, worked on the tunnel project.
For those who might not know, Glen Ferris is a town that is in Fayette County, West Virginia, where the project took place.
And he was a young man in his early 20s at the time. He was an engineer for Reinhart and Dennis, which was the subsidiary company of Union Carbide that built the tunnel. And he was employed as an engineer.
Mr. Arthur Payton was one of the estimated 5,000 men who were hired. And of those men, nearly 3,000 worked inside of the tunnel. Only 738 of those men inside the tunnel were white. Reinhart and Dennis claimed that most of the men employed, especially those inside the tunnel, were local men who had experience in coal mining or digging tunnels. According to Dr. Cherniak in his book, The Hawk's Nest Incident, less than 20% of the men were from local areas. In all, 65% of the entire workforce were African-American, while nearly 80% of men in Fayette County were white. The story that Reinhart and Dennis was telling was simply fiction. The tunnel, which turned out to be over 16,000 feet long, was created to divert water from the New River through Gauley Mountain to hydroelectric turbines. This would provide electricity to a Union Carbide subsidiary company, which means that Union Carbide fully or partially owned the company. First, it's crucial to understand the history of the company that started it all. In 1917, four companies merged together to form the Union Carbide and Carbon Corporation, which is now called Union Carbide. Then 3 years later, the company opened the first commercial ethylene plant in Clendenin, West Virginia. Union Carbide saw the opportunity for efficient hydroelectric power in the region thanks to the swift currents of the New River. For a while, they kept it under wraps that they were planning on using the New River. But by 1924, they had already created maps detailing how they'd produce hydroelectric power. The plan was to build the plant in Boncar, which is now called Alloy. Then, in 1927, they created the New Kanawha Power Company, which was another subsidiary that was fully owned by Union Carbide. According to Dr. Cherniak in his book, the company was developed to construct public utilities in West Virginia. He even went as far to say that no one attempted to pretend that the new company was anything more than a legal fiction made by Union Carbide. But thanks to their creative efforts, in 1929, the West Virginia Public Service Commission gave the New Kanawha Power Company a permit as a public utility. This meant that the company was now free to produce hydroelectric electricity as a public service. But it never did, at least under its own name. In fact, going to the West Virginia Public Service Commission was a second choice. In 1927, the New Kanawha Power Company filed a declaration of intent to pursue the New River with the Federal Power Commission, but nothing was said or done. So the company filed the intent with the Public Service Commission. Dr. Cherniak said that the commission was predictable for Union Carbide, for they considered it to be a reliable partner. A few years earlier, another company had asked the commission for permission to build a dam in the New River. The commission denied this request because they believed that because Union Carbide had already bought so much land near the river, they should be the company utilizing the New River instead. So Union Carbide seemed to know that the permission was theirs for whenever they were to ask. Even though Union Carbide admitted that the New Kanawha Power Company was completely owned by them and all the power produced there would go straight to Union Carbide, it was still given the green light. To finally start the project, Union Carbide needed to contract a company to build the tunnel. In turn, 35 contractors bid on the project in 1929. In 1930, the project was given to Reinhart and Dennis, the lowest bidder. Although they were the lowest bidder, they weren't the least experienced. In 30 years, Reinhart and Dennis had constructed 150 tunnels, so Union Carbide knew that they could do the job at hand and gave them a 2-year contract. Soon, the lies and corruption made by these corporations will be brought to light. And even though they did not have modern engineering, it was still quickly completed. In fact, it finished 10 weeks ahead of schedule. There are a few reasons as to why they might have rushed to complete the project. For one, they might have been trying to complete it before the Federal Power Commission got back to them about the request they had filed to even start building the tunnel. But there were some incentives for Reinhart and Dennis to finish the project. The American Society of Safety Professionals found that Reinhart and Dennis owed $250 for each day they went over the target. For each day they beat the target, the New Kanawha Power Company would pay Reinhart and Dennis $250 a day. To learn more about the science behind the tunnel, I sat down with geologist Ken Ashton in Morgantown, West Virginia.
Well, that neck of the woods, if anything, actually, that location is perfect geologically for a tunnel of that sort. I mean, they couldn't have found a better place. That rock's nice and clean. That's, you know, almost every tunnel that you ever go through has to have lining over it. If you ever, you know, any roadway tunnel, railway tunnel, because you're going through various types of bedrock. And anytime you have different types of bedrock, they're going to weather away at different rates and you're going to have problems. So basically all tunnels are lined. But this one, they didn't have to. They got away with not lining about a third of that 3-mile tunnel because of that beautiful Nuttall sandstone there. That beautiful Nuttall sandstone also is what generated lots of dust and pretty much did them in. But you know, it cost a lot more money to line it. They saved a lot of money by not having to line it. And it was just a win-win for Union Carbide all along.
While this rock might have made for a clean project, it was more valuable than Union Carbide realized. This rock was high-grade silica. So Union Carbide decided to widen the unlined part of the tunnel in order to get their hands on the silica. The American Society of Safety Professionals report that Union Carbide was able to deliver 300,000 tons of silica a day, transporting it to their plant in Alloy. But this valuable silica is where it all goes downhill.
So they were just blasting the crap out of that stuff. And if you're not wearing a mask and you're blasting apart a very quartz-rich sandstone, you know, this stuff is about 99% silica. It's an extremely high silica sand, made purely out of silica dioxide sand grains. You're gonna liberate a lot of dust. So they're, you know, just blowing this rock to smithereens and liberating all this stuff, and these guys are breathing it. And you know, you don't complain when you're getting paid, otherwise you get fired because there's somebody else waiting to take the job. So you know, the workers aren't complaining until they start hacking their heads off and they can't do anything. So again, it was just like the perfect storm for carbide to pull this huge task off.
As it would soon show, these men were literally dying to have a job.
The family story always was that from my aunts and others in the family, that you would see African Americans hoboing in from the South on the C&O Railroad. Hoboing means that they caught a freight train and just got on board a boxcar and what's called a reefer car and came up to the project. And there were camps set up all over Valley Bridge area, Glen Ferris, and at various points at the two headings of the tunnel. When the tunnel construction began, the engineering part of it was remarkable because they began at the upper point at near Anstead on the New River. And then another heading was at the downstream point. And those two headings would meet essentially in the middle, drilling from both ends. And the story goes that when the drilling was done, they were only an inch off in terms of meeting up exactly, which is pretty darn good engineering. You know, we think today that engineering can't be done unless you have a computer to tell you how to do it. Well, they had slide rules to tell them what they were doing, and it worked quite well.
Maybe in another life, we would recognize the Hawk's Nest Tunnel for what it set out to be, an engineering marvel. But in this life, this reality, that tunnel was the entryway that led many workers right into an early tomb. Thank you for listening to episode 1 of Into the Tunnel. This podcast is the product of research conducted for a master's project at West Virginia University's Reed College of Media. All episodes can be found on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.